And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Dr. Sunna M. Laybourne to the program today. Dr. Laybourne is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Memphis. Her research has been published in Ethnic and Racial Studies, Sociology of Race and Ethnicity, Sociology Compass, and Asian Pacific American Law Journal. Her co-authored book entitled Diversity in Black Greek Letter Organizations, Breaking the Line, was published by Routledge in 2018. Today, we'll be discussing her new book, Out of Place, The Lives of Korean Adoptee Immigrants, which is published by NYU Press. Sunna, how many children have been adopted from Korea and brought to America since the end of World War II?
Over 150,000 children since the end of World War II. And so right after the Korean War, we start to see particularly mixed-race children, mixed-race Korean children being adopted into the U.S. And then by the 1980s, once Korean adoption really becomes institutionalized, then we see much larger numbers of Korean children. And then we see quote-unquote, full-blooded Korean children being adopted into American families.
And so was that the mixed-race children mainly a result of the Korean War and
Correct.
The American presence there?
Absolutely.
You also stated that Korean children were adopted to other countries around the world. Where else did they go during this time?
In Europe, primarily. So U.S. and then various countries in Europe.
How did Korea develop this industry?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it really is a response to the Korean War, but not just from the Korean side, but also from the American side as well. So if we take a trip back into history and we're thinking about the Korean War, which technically never ended, right? So more so in a stalemate, we still had the demilitarized zone. And so this was not the clear victory that the U.S. wanted on the Korean Peninsula. And so, in fact, there was a lot of coordinated action by the U.S. government to kind of save face, right? To make sure that this war effort was not seen as a failure at home, but also abroad. So the United States government, the United States military did a lot of humanitarian efforts after the Korean War and showing that our presence was still necessary. And so post-Korean War, immediately in that, you know, early 1950s time period, we see the U.S. military and U.S. government creating a lot of orphanages for now, you know, orphan children or children separated from their families. Now the U.S. is seen as having this humanitarian presence. And so that's where we first start seeing Korean adoption taking place. So we have these Korean children who, you know, don't have any families or aren't connected to their families or unclear about where their parents are. We have the U.S. providing this humanitarian service. Also in Korea at this time, there was a lot of stigma around mixed race Korean children. So then that was also a push saying these children have nowhere to go. We're able to take them in as Americans, right, and kind of do our American duty as humanitarians, but also tied to ideas of Christianity. So we're able to show our Christian values by adopting Korean children. Again, if we think back in history, missionaries were some of the only Americans outside of military that were in Korea. So there was also that direct communication from American missionaries in Korea to their churches back at home. So that's where you see this idea of we can show our Christian values by adopting these children and taking care of orphans. And then after that, then we start to see Korean adoption actually becoming formally institutionalized and actually creating the adoption industry that we know of today.
What was the attitude of people in Korea when it moved past biracial children? What were their attitudes toward so many of their children?
Right, yeah. I mean, I think that's such a great question because by the time the 1980s, when Korean adoption is really solidified, right, and we have thousands of Korean children being adopted out, primarily to the U.S., but again, to other countries as well. By this time, Korea also has established itself and really rebuilt itself as a nation post the Korean War. And so you have a lot of mixed feelings from the Korean people. So on one hand, there's a lot of shame around the Korean War. There's also a lot of grief around the separation, again, ongoing separation of Korean families, not just because of the division between North and South Korea, right? But also, again, as you mentioned, Korean children being adopted out. Very infamously, we have the 1988 Olympics that are happening in Korea and North Korea actually condemning South Korea, saying you are sending all of your children away. And so, again, another layer of shame amongst the Korean people for, again, as you mentioned, sending so many of their children away. And so a lot of mixed feelings, as you might imagine, one in thinking about, okay, was this a necessary response after the war? But then also, why are we continuing this practice?
Currently, many industrialized nations, and including in Asia, Japan, China, and Korea, are suffering from a demographic shift.
Yes.
And there are a lot more older people and a lot fewer young people. Do you think that's played a prominent role in, for Korea, at least, in this demographic shift?
I think that's such a great question. In East Asia, also we could think about even in here in the U.S., it costs a lot to raise a family. And we see some of those pressures particularly pronounced in East Asia as well, where younger people are saying, whoa, you know, it's very expensive to even have children. And so we see a big decline, as you mentioned, in the population replacement rate.
You write that the overwhelming majority of children adopted from Korea into America were by white parents. Mm-hmm. Are there any statistics that give us an idea of what that actual percentage was? Or?
You know, I don't know of any statistics off the top of my head that speak to that. But what I can tell you is, as I write in the book, the majority of Korean children are being adopted into white families. And we could think about that for a few different reasons. One, thinking about in the 1950s, 1960s, and then onward, thinking about social service agencies and racism within case management, within social work itself. And so even though we have Black American families who wanted to adopt, they were excluded for a variety of different reasons from being able to adopt Korean children. Now, in that initial post-war period, so again, thinking early 1950s, and you have mixed race Korean children, then those children were actually sorted along the black-white color line. So white Korean mixed race children were slotted to be adopted into white families, and Black Korean mixed race children were slotted to be adopted into Black families. Corey Graves actually has a really great book called A War Born Family, which talks about African American families and adoption from Korea. And she really delves into that history about some of the intentional decision making that case managers and social work as a field was making in order to include but also exclude Black American families from adopting from Korea specifically.
Was one of the possible drivers of this for white families adopting? We're in Memphis. You teach at the University of Memphis. Tennessee Home Society and Georgia Tan, the big adoption scandal from Memphis, mm-hmm. that really affected, I think, the way adoptions were handled inside of America. Do you think that was a big driver that
pushed this? Is such a good question, you know, and I love that connection, you know, here to our home area. You know, I think a few different things were happening. So one, you have adoption, domestic adoption really decreasing, and we can think about differences in ability to adopt internationally, which was still very, very rare. So we saw some instances of it happening before Korean adoption. But so you have a few like push-pull factors. So availability of children domestically, availability of children internationally, and not having an institutionalized, formalized process prior to Korean adoption. And then also you have, again, a lot of publicity and a lot of push towards adopting these Korean orphans. And again, as a way for the U.S. to really show its standing on the global stage in particular. And again, to really save face after what was a loss in the Korean War.
With the rationalization of, oh, we're helping these young people from Korea, mm-hmm. after the war, especially with interracial kids who may not find a comfortable home there. As you move into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, when Korea's economy has developed greatly,
right.
What's the rationalization at that point?
Yeah, at this point, we have just a formalized adoption industry, and you have a lot of American families who want to adopt. And so again, then we really get into the decrease in domestic availability of children. Again, Korea is still the primary sending country at this point, and so it becomes a known pathway to expand your family.
Do you think the lessening of the stigma for single mothers in America helped contribute to that lessening of domestic supply?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So decreasing stigma and also rise in birth control as well.
How did you undertake your research for the scholarship?
I am a Korean adoptee myself. So in many ways, I had a natural in, right, with this population of folks. While on the other hand, as you mentioned, for me growing up here in Memphis, I wasn't connected to a Korean adoptee community. So in that way, I also didn't have those networks of Korean adoptees that I could tap into. But for me, for this book, what I wanted to make sure that I did was had a variety of voices. So I was able to conduct a survey of Korean adoptees from across across the United States, also interview adoptees, and also attend Korean adoptee events across the U.S. and in Korea as well. What I really wanted to do was to get a sense of the range of experiences that folks had, both folks who were raised in different regions of the United States, but also folks who were adopted in different decades as well, to see, you know, what are the similarities, but what are the differences, and to really get a fuller, more nuanced picture of the Korean adoptee experience. And then the other piece is I also wanted to draw in Korean adoptee cultural production. So thinking about documentaries, movies, essays, blogs, etc., all the other ways that Korean adoptees have said, hey, we want to be able to tell our own stories from our viewpoints. You know, with adoption, we often hear a lot from adoptive parents or a lot from the social worker side, but oftentimes adoptees and especially birth parents are left out of those stories. And while I'm not able to incorporate stories of birth parents in this book, what I am able to do is to incorporate a lot of voices and perspectives from Korean adoptees.
Now, since you are in this cohort, obviously you've got insights that another person wouldn't have, but did you find that your experience presented any challenges in studying people that you do have this in common with?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because sometimes we take for granted some of the things that we know, right? If we're a part of a group, we kind of just take for granted maybe some of the shared ideas or the shared activities or even the shared language that we use. So there was kind of that both and. For me, conducting this research was really my first entry point into Korean adoptee community. So as I mentioned, growing up here in Memphis, I wasn't aware of any other Korean adoptees. I wasn't part of an adoptee community, let alone a Korean adoptee community. And so once I actually started getting connected in this actual global network of Korean adoptees, I myself was kind of learning what it meant to be a Korean adoptee in community with other Korean adoptees. So for me, it actually, I think, what helped with my research is because I was so new to making connections with other Korean adoptees and learning about the community, I was also able to write down kind of all of the insights I was having about, you know, taken for granted activities, questions, and experiences that I didn't know were even shared among other Korean adoptees. So I think in that instance, it was helpful because I was still able to kind of bring those fresh eyes to all of the interactions and really question, hey, what's going on here? But in other ways, I think it also was helpful because for Korean adoptees, you know, there's also a little bit of hesitancy to share your story, wondering if it's going to be misrepresented, right? And so there was also a level of trust that came into play since I was talking to other Korean adoptees and I am a Korean adoptee. And so there were a few different things happening. And I will say this, you know, something I didn't expect in undertaking this research was really the how emotional it made me feel, right? Listening to people's stories, it takes an emotional toll while you're processing, you know, some of the shared information that you're getting from folks. And so there was a lot of moments where I really had to just, you know, take a moment to decompress because, again, also I am a Korean adoptee, so I am sympathizing and empathizing with the folks that I was able to interview.
What other research projects have you done in sociology before that you weren't as intimately familiar with?
Yeah, you know what? I think I am one of those researchers that it's all about the me-search, you know, and I know that's sometimes that term is used to try to stigmatize or look down upon the research that scholars do when you're researching something you're intimately familiar with, right? The groups that you're a part of or even the interests that you have. But prior to this project, I was working primarily on a project about nightlife and about how folks create identity in that space. So a lot of my research is around social psychology, so all about identity, how we see ourselves, how we show up in the world, the communities that we're a part of. And I said me-search because I used to work in nightlife, and that's what really, you know, piqued my interest about this. I mean, all of us, whether we're researchers formally or not, we're always curious about the world that's happening. We're wondering, why is this going on like this? Or why are these folks acting like this? Or what's happening in this space? And so for me, working in nightlife, I had those similar questions of, you know, why do folks come here every single weekend, right? But again, that sense of community, that sense of belonging that we can create in a variety of different spaces and places.
Since I'm an old white guy from the South, the Willie Nelson song, "The Nightlife Ain't No Good Life, But It's My Life," comes to mind. So you have all these anecdotal snippets in the book, mm-hmm. and you want to show the breadth of experience.
Yeah.
But beyond the act of adoption from Korea, were there any kind of universal themes that you saw across all these people you spoke with?
you know, universal to Korean adoptees, but I think universal to just people in general that need to connect with one another, that need to understand that you do have a place, right? So the book is out of place, The Lives of Korean Adoptee Immigrants, but it's really a play on this idea of, in many ways, Korean adoptees are positioned as being out of place, and how we often think about what it means to be family or what it means to be a member of a racial group or ethnic group, or even, you know, in terms of nation, right, and citizenship. But for Korean adoptees, they're able to create a place and space for each other outside of these constraints and limitations. And I found that very empowering, that even though Korean adoptees, again, adopted all across the U.S. and even around the world, but still finding one another and creating a sense of community. And I thought that was really beautiful. And I think for a lot of folks, and you don't have to be a Korean adoptee, you know, we all need community. And there are some things that maybe we've experienced or some characteristics that we have that we think, you know, keep us very isolated and apart from one another. But I guarantee you there are other people out there who have experienced the same thing or even maybe struggling through something similar. And you all need each other because we all need each other. We are social creatures and we have to have that community and those connections.
So with Korean adoptees who were raised in families that were in more diverse urban settings mm-hmm. versus those who were raised in more homogenous suburban or rural settings, did you see any kind of general trends that differentiated them?
Yeah, that's such a good question because, you know how you can live in a city that is very racially diverse overall, but your immediate community or neighborhood could still be racially homogenous, right? And so that's actually what I found, that it was very rare for Korean adoptees, even if they were in a city that was, again, very racially and ethnically diverse, oftentimes their immediate contexts were still racially homogenous and usually predominantly white because, again, these adoptees are primarily being adopted into white families. So they might live in a city that has a sizable Asian American population, but yet their immediate neighborhood, the schools they were going to, the churches, you know, the other types of activities they were involved in were still primarily white. And so I think that also speaks to the ways that we can often stay siloed in our little bubbles, right? For the Korean adoptees who experienced that, right, who were in, again, cities with that were more racially diverse, you know, it wasn't until they were older, you know, after high school, when they're in college, or at least, you know, over that 18 years of age, that they were able to actually explore and make connections, not just with other Korean adoptees, but maybe also other Asian Americans.
The first chapter of the book deals with adoptees and how they kind of fit in with their families and this concept of whiteness in America mm-hmm. and growing to understand that there is a level of privilege available inside yeah. a white family, but that it does not extend very far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's quite a paradox for Korean adoptees who are raised in white families because they're a part of their families, right? They're a kid, they're a part of their families, but a lot of the decisions that their parents are making are decisions that are shaping their experiences through a very white lens, right? So I mentioned how maybe you're in a racially diverse city, but your immediate neighborhood is still predominantly white and the schools you go to are still predominantly white. And so for Korean adoptees, they both were, you know, experiencing their family through this lens of shared whiteness, but then also understanding that in many ways there was a barrier for them to experience belonging or to experience and understand the world through that white lens because the world was not experiencing them or perceiving them as white. And so therefore they were being treated as not white. So for Korean adoptees, that was one common experience, was trying to reconcile this idea of I am a part of my family is white, but I'm not white. You know, and so having to really understand, okay, to what extent does then or to what extent is my family belonging then maybe being challenged if I'm not able to attain kind of this white experience that my other family members are having?
Another thing that complicates this is generally for adoptees, and then in this specific case with Korean adoptees, especially those adopted after the war, is this expectation and almost demand for gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for folks who are growing up in the families that they're biologically related to, you probably don't think about or aren't expected to be grateful, right? In certain ways, your parents kind of sometimes might say you should be more grateful. But the ways in which adoptees are really expected to be grateful at all times and to never be able to critique or say that, hey, you know, my childhood wasn't that great, is something that is very distinct to adoptees, right? And also shows how we think about families and adoptive families in particular is very different than families that have shared DNA. And so for Korean adoptees, another common experience was this feeling of not being able to really relax or be comfortable in your family, because there's always, when you're not able to show your full range of emotions, right, then that means you're not able to show up as your full self. And so for many Korean adoptees and other adoptees as well, there is this expectation that, you know, you were saved, so you must be grateful at all times. Or for Korean adoptees or other international adoptees, that, oh, you know, you were brought to America, right, with all of these opportunities, you should be grateful. And so anytime that you might have, you know, a well-founded critique or even a question, it seems as though you're being ungrateful. And oftentimes adoptees find themselves being silenced because of that.
I thought it was interesting. There was an example of an adoptee whose adoptive mother was German. Mm-hmm. And I know of two Asian adoptee friends whose mothers were German as well. It would seem like that was fairly common occurrence.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we can think about, again, these pathways of how folks end up adopting, a lot of times through various social work agencies that were either ethnic or religious, right, related or affiliated. And so you can think about those communities and how we share information, right, with people within our communities. Actually, you know, my adoptive family, German as well. But I also think that speaks to a little bit of the Midwestern part and those pathways of a lot of Korean adoptees being adopted into the Midwest. And so, again, thinking about other former or even prior immigration pathways of other immigrant, ethnic immigrant groups as well. And so, again, we think about how we share information and how we learn about what's available to us, again, within our communities. And so, yes, you do see a lot of folks with shared ethnic or even shared religious backgrounds participating in international adoption.
Did you notice any, there might have been differences in different regions of the country where people were adopted into mm-hmm. and their experiences?
That's a great question, because I really expected there to be a lot of regional variability, right? Because our regions are so distinct. But what I found amongst the Korean adoptees that I surveyed and spoke with, there were oftentimes more similarities than differences. I really expected for, you know, adoptees in the South to have a very unique Southern experience versus in the Northeast. And primarily what I saw was more commonalities than anything. And I think part of that has to do with how there's a shared commonality of whiteness across the U.S. And again, since the Korean adoptees I spoke with primarily adopted into white families, that was what was really coming out more than some of the regional distinctions that I, you know, went into the research thinking that I would find.
Because this concept of a national whiteness in America, to me, just blows my mind, because people seem so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people are definitely very different. But when we think about kind of these broader ideas of whiteness, and that is very similar in the sense that the adoptees that I spoke with, again, growing up in white families, feeling very white, having white parents who felt that they're Koreanness or their Asianness was not very central, right? And not important, that it was kind of optional. And so that was something that was definitely similar across the adoptees that I spoke with.
So these broader concept of Asianness mm-hmm. and whiteness / Europeanness, do those only kind of find power outside of those home continents in America or other continents that aren't Europe or Asia?
I think that's such an interesting question. For one, I think that this idea of whiteness as a system of power, right, is not just a U.S.-based system, but also we see globally. So in that sense, you know, that has a certain meaning around the world and not just, you know, here in the U.S., but certainly around the world. And then this idea of Asianness, when we think about in the U.S. context, we've had a variety of different laws throughout our history that have excluded Asians from immigrating, but also excluding Asians who are here from naturalizing. And so I talk a little bit about in the book about connecting this idea of who we think is American to both ideas of whiteness, which other scholars have talked about, but also against ideas of Asianness as foreigners, right? And so we really see this playing out within the lives of Korean adoptees who are, you know, very intimately a part of whiteness, a part of white families, but also contending with these broader historical ideas of Asians as being foreigners. And that's something we see continue to pop up in the U.S. I mean, we could think about COVID-19 and again, these ideas of, oh, Asians are foreigners, they're a threat to our national security, and a lot of anti-Asian attitudes that popped up during COVID.
Do you think a lot of that may have been lessened if we hadn't have had the exclusion and there had been long histories of 6-7 generations of folks living here and establishing themselves? Or?
I think yes and no, because, I mean, we have a long history of Asians in America over, you know, hundreds of years.
But in very small numbers. Compared.
Right, in very small numbers, for sure. And so, again, I think to your point, if we had more actual inclusion throughout, then maybe we'd see some different attitudes. But who's to say?
Most of the anecdotal responses we see are fairly brief, a paragraph mm-hmm. or two. But the experience of Adam Krapser is one we see in the most detail, and it's mm-hmm. just a heartbreaking story.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely heartbreaking. So Adam Krapser is a Korean adoptee. He was deported back to Korea. And so his case is something I do spend a lot of time on in the book because it was highly covered in national media when it first started. So 2016, Adam Krapser is, you know, reapplying for a green card. You know, he thinks he's doing everything that he's supposed to do in order to have, you know, his green card status, and his green card application is flagged. His background check is flagged because he did commit a crime previously. He served time for that crime. But because of change in immigration laws, now even immigrants who have, you know, if they committed a crime, served time, they can still be deported. And so this is what ends up happening to him. And it becomes an interesting case because Adam was adopted as a toddler from Korea to the U.S., but his parents never naturalized him. And so a lot of parents did not know that they needed to naturalize their internationally adopted child. You know, they're thinking, oh, this is my kid, right? But adoption and naturalization or adoption and immigration are two separate processes. And so while they legally adopted their child, they didn't legally naturalize their child and ensure their citizenship. And so a few dozen international adoptees, not just Korean adoptees, but adoptees from other countries have been deported back to their birth countries. And then there's, you know, it's unclear how many potential international adoptees are vulnerable to deportation, but there are some estimates up to 30,000 or more of just Korean adoptees. And again, we know that international adoption has been happening from a variety of different countries around the globe. And so I talk about Adam's case because it really brings up this question of how can we adopt these children and then once they reach adulthood say, well, you know, you're on your own and really exclude them from, you know, the nation that has been their home. And so I talk a lot about his case and really those questions that it raises. And then also it enables me to think about, you know, what are the legislative challenges, but also opportunities. And so in the book, I also talk about a lot of advocacy around an adoptee citizenship act that would actually grant retroactive citizenship to adoptees who were adopted before the Child Citizenship Act of 2000, which actually was tried to close that loophole between adoption and immigration. But of course, a lot of adoptees weren't covered under that bill.
And he was able to successfully sue the adoption agency.
He was able to sue the adoption agency. He also sued the Korean government. Not successful, no surprise there. So he was deported back to Korea. And that's when he filed both of those lawsuits. And the Korean government did find Holt Adoption Agency responsible for neglect of not following up on what happened to the children whose adoptions they facilitated. But the Korean government, of course, did not find itself responsible for any failures that they may have had. But, you know, now there are other lawsuits. There are other investigations that are happening in Korea in terms of international adoption. And so that's because of the work of Korean adoptees, both in the U.S., but also in Europe, in various countries in Europe as well, that are saying, hey, these adoptions, there's a lot of fraudulent paperwork. There's mismatch between the paperwork I have from my, you know, home agency and the agency in Korea. And also saying, like, the Korean government, like, you had to have known this was happening, right? Like, what role did you play? And so, again, ongoing cases. And so we'll see what happens in Korea and then what that might mean for other countries and the international adoption industry overall.
Did you find any differences in experience and attitudes from people who were adopted in the 50s and 60s versus the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few changes. So one, we have much more awareness of both multiculturalism, but also diversity. And so in some ways, we have the adoptees who were adopted in the 80s and 90s, and even beyond, being a little more cognizant, you know, wanting to explore their Korean heritage, wanting to explore what it means to be Asian in America, and having a few more opportunities to do so, right? Whereas adoptees who were adopted in the 50s and 60s, you know, is very much an assimilationist attitude. Right? That you are completely American, that you shouldn't explore your ethnic heritage. And so that was definitely an attitude or a way that Korean adoptees in those earlier decades were raised a little bit more prominently than adoptees in other decades. But overall, there are a lot of similarities in the sense that Korean adoptees kind of, while there were more opportunities to maybe explore their heritage, they were also felt a little bit discouraged from doing so because their families oftentimes didn't provide a variety of opportunities or connections for them to explore, even though the adoptees themselves had that desire.
There are some terms in the book. It's a work of professional scholarship. And there's some terms here that you can help me out with. And
okay.
Might maybe help out our listeners too. What is racialization?
Yeah, racialization is just the process of race making, right? And so we often think about race as something that's biological, that's something that's inherent in our DNA in some way, which it's not, right? There is no gene for our race, but rather we create the idea of race. So it's a social process, right? We give meaning to what it means to be a member of a racial group. And so racialization is that process of how we make meaning into race, how we decide that different physical features mean that you must be a member of a certain racial group, or even how you might dress or how you might talk, the words you may use, or even different cultural practices. We all give that meaning and assign racial meaning in particular to these different both physical attributes, but even different social attributes as well.
Racial melancholia.
Oh, so this is a term that I recently learned, and it's actually the work of David Ng in particular. He and Shin-hee wrote a book called Racial Melancholia and Racial Dissociation. And so racial melancholia is this idea, and they talk about it in terms in relation to Asian Americans, but it could apply to other immigrant groups in particular as well. So this idea of knowing that you can never really be a part of, in this case, you know, what it means to be American. And so they talk about both this national identity and racial identity and how it's intertwined.
And disidentification.
Disidentification. Yes. Yeah, so this idea, again, similar, of course, because the book is talking a lot about race and race making or racialization, right? Now that we know that word. But thinking about disidentification. So exactly as it sounds like, right? So the ways that we are not able to identify with or excluded from identification with, again, thinking here in terms of racial group membership.
You've mentioned the documentary Twinsters before, and there's another one, AKA Soul. What effect did they have on the adoptee community in America?
Yeah, these are such great documentaries. So I talk about them in the book because of how they really gave, in particular, Korean adoptees a way to see themselves represented. I know recently we've talked a lot about representation kind of just overall in the United States. And for Korean adoptees and really adoptees overall, there are very few media where we can look at and see someone who looks like us having an experience that is full of nuance, full of hope, full of questioning, right? Full of sadness, and seeing from another adoptee's perspective. Again, not an adoptive parent, not from a case management or social work perspective. And so Twinsters, which was on Netflix, which people may have seen, two Korean adoptees who were separated at birth, adopted to different countries, one to the U.S., one to France, and they end up finding one another and kind of go through this journey of, you know, learning that they have a twin, but then also kind of exploring their Korean roots and also exploring the Korean adoptee community. And I think what Twinsters did in particular, because it was released through Netflix, is that it opened it up to a broader audience and also opened it up to more adoptees, Korean adoptees in particular, stumbling upon it, right? So in certain ways, you know, there's the media that we search for, and then there's the media that Netflix will recommend you something, or that you might just see as you're scrolling through. And so what I really see is the power of Twinsters is that part of the twins' exploration into their Korean heritage and into the Korean adoptee community, they go back to Seoul for ICA, which is the International Korean Adoptee Association's conference. And so they go to this conference. There's some clips of it, you know, in the documentary. And after Twinsters comes out, there's another ICA conference in Seoul. And you see a lot of the folks who are attending this conference are attending because they saw Twinsters. So I think that just really speaks to how powerful media can be to, again, to find community, to also get connected to community in real life, right? So folks were so moved by watching Twinsters and learning about this conference, they actually attended. And I thought that was really powerful and really unique. AKA Seoul is great because it was distributed through NBC Asian America. And again, a broader audience and really repositioning Korean adoptees into the Asian American experience, which for a very long time, adoptees were not part of how we told Asian American history. And we might think about some, again, reasons about shame around that or not seeing adoptees as part of the Asian American experience. But in fact, Korean adoption is very central to Asian American immigration. And so AKA Seoul, again, broadening the audience for Korean adoptees, for non-adoptees as well. And I think most importantly, resituating Korean adoptees as part of what it means to be Asian in America.
Well, and you're right that there's some disconnect between Korean adoptees and Korean Americans, that, that the experience is very different and it doesn't lead to the easiest of communication between each other. But also with the recent rise in Korean popular culture getting big in America and across the world, those two things, how do those work together?
Yeah, I mean, such a great question, because on one hand, you have Korean adoptees, as you mentioned, because of the unique way that Korean adoptees come to the United States, the families that they're raised in, you know, they don't have that same familial experience that Korean Americans who are raised in Korean American families are having. So there is a little bit of a mismatch in the culture, right? There's not that shared culture in many ways. On the other hand, what I find is very interesting is for a lot of Korean Americans, you know, second generation or even third generation, they actually have a lot of similar feelings to Korean adoptees in terms of being caught between two cultures, right? Or not really knowing where they fit in. And I think that is very similar. I remember going to a Korean American conference and a lot of, again, second generation, even third generation, that's what they were talking about feeling caught between two cultures, about not knowing where they fit in, about feeling like they weren't Korean enough or weren't American enough. And I was like, wow, this sounds very similar to what a lot of Korean adoptees say. You know, a little bit of a different perspective or a different lens, but the overall themes very similar. But for Korean adoptees, often feeling excluded from Korean American or even Asian American communities because they weren't raised in Asian American families. And so that is definitely happening. The other piece that you mentioned, which is, you know, the popularity of Korean culture in particular, K-pop, food, K-dramas, even the historical Korean movies, and Korean adoptees oftentimes feeling both a part of and separate from that as well. So in many ways, you know how, you know, oftentimes we want to talk about, you know, what's authentic or gatekeep some of these cultural experiences. And so then for many Korean adoptees, again, not raised in Korean American families or Korean families, oftentimes feeling a little bit excluded as well, though feeling, I think, very much a little bit of a paradox of Korean culture being so celebrated now. When they were growing up, being Korean was seen as something as very different and undesirable.
Do you have any particular favorite Korean culture products recently?
Well, I'm really into all of Korean skincare, of course, and Korean food. Yeah, I love to eat.
What's your next field of research that you're undertaking?
Ooh, you know, it feels like I'm finally able to get to some other projects, right? The book definitely took over my entire life for a couple years, but in a very good way. And then it feels so good to have the book out in the world so people can share it and enjoy it. My next project, I'm actually looking into what was the reception of Japanese Americans post-internment, and in particular, thinking about in academia. So we know that when Japanese internment happened, a lot of folks were, you know, college students and weren't able to complete their college education. And even after post-internment, a lot of schools didn't accept them back, even the schools that they were previously enrolled in. And so I'm really interested in how Japanese Americans were received after that, particularly in education, and specifically how historically Black colleges and universities receive Japanese American students. I heard this one little tidbit of information years ago that HBCUs or some HBCUs accepted Japanese American students after internment. And that always, it made me wonder, you know, to what extent is that true and why, right? I mean, we can think about reasons why, but as far as what data can I find that really speaks to this? And what I found was that at Fisk University, so Nashville, right up the street from us, in the post-internment period, they did have a Japanese-American master's student, a woman, and then they also had a Japanese professor employed there, actually for several decades. And so I'm starting, you know, here in Tennessee, examining, you know, what does that mean for how we think about Japanese-Americans, Black Americans, race, and also the South?
Well, Sanaa, I want to thank you so much for coming by today and sharing Out of Place with us. It's been quite the pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Sanaa N. Laybourne is the author of Out of Place, The Lives of Korean Adoptee Immigrants, which is published by NYU Press. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.